Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Without question, AUKUS is a big bet for Australia, and yet we still don't have answers to so many of the key questions.
Will it be delivered? Can we trust Washington? Will they expect us to join them in any future conflict with China?
Perhaps that's why the US has sent one of its most experienced hands and soothing senators down under. I certainly have questions for Senator Tim Kaine from the place the subs are built, Virginia.
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Let's down Periscope for Global Roaming.
Well, Geraldine, it's not often that we get the opportunity to ask questions of a senior US official about AUKUS, about its viability, its delivery, and even what their expectations are of us in the event of conflict. So it's a great opportunity that we have with Senator Tim Kaine to sit down and test some of those issues.
Yes, he's been touring Australia, looking at the relevant AUKUS sites in South Australia and WA, and he's actually in Darwin, where, of course, he's marking the anniversary of the bombing of Darwin. Now, he is a very interesting man. He represents Virginia, where the subs are being built, the AUKUS subs are being built. He sits really at the interface between the Pentagon, or now the Department of War, the military, the spooks, Trump's people, and us. He is on the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committee. So AUKUS, you know, is very much in his wheelhouse.
So even though he's a Democrat, he's right in the detail of this. And you're going to hear a lot about bipartisan support for AUKUS in Washington. Maybe there's also bipartisan support for us spending more on defence.
I wonder why that would be. On their defence.
We're going to get into all of that. But I know from you listeners, as you've engaged with us on AUKUS over the past few years, there's a real question about, does America assume that Australia would participate in the event of conflict between the US and China because of the procurement of these submarines? And we're really going to get into that. You might recognise the name Tim Kaine. He was Hillary Clinton's running mate in that 2016 fateful presidential election. He does carry harmonicas with him.
And he does pride himself on being bipartisan, which, you know, we see here so little of from the US here in Australia.
On some issues.
On some issues.
He's only giving a handful of interviews while he's here in Australia. We're delighted that he's chosen to talk to us here at Global Roaming. Senator Tim Kaine, welcome to Global Roaming.
So good to be with you guys. Thanks.
You've been on a tour of the country and some particular facilities and bases this week. Have you seen anything in Australia that convinces you that this thing, AUKUS, is actually going to happen?
I've not been doubtful about AUKUS. I've been a supporter since President Biden first announced it. I think after President Trump was elected, there was kind of a months of drama as we waited to see whether President Trump would continue to embrace what had been announced by his predecessor. So when the prime minister came to Washington in the fall and the full steam ahead message came out of the president following that meeting, everything since that I've seen has been very, very strong on the U.S. side in terms of commitment. It's always been bipartisan in Congress, Democrat, Republican, House, Senate. But what I wanted to do is now come over, once that commitment has been made, to just really talk about implementation. What, you know, what's going well? What are challenges that we have to meet? Assess some of the progress. You know, I have a lot of thoughts about this on the U.S. side, but it was the right time to come and visit Perth, Adelaide. I'm in Darwin, and I'll be in Sydney for a couple of days to really assess the progress on the Australian side.
But I guess you're talking to a lot of Australians who are quite skeptical of this thing. Maybe you're describing words, language.
And budgets.
Okay, budgets as well. But have you seen anything physical?
Oh, yes. So the AUKUS review, which is classified, I've read the entire thing, but I think I can talk about it generally, raised some questions about, is Australia investing in the infrastructure at a pace consistent with what we hope to do? And I have definitely seen that. I arrived on Sunday, and within 90 minutes, the announcement came out, Prime Minister and the Premier of South Australia, about the investments at the Osborne Shipyard in Adelaide. And I toured that shipyard. I saw the ongoing work on Hunter-class frigates and on Collins-class submarines. We then went to Perth, and I spent yesterday touring both Stirling and Henderson sites, punctuated by a meeting in the middle of those two tours with local mayors. And then I went over to Henderson and saw similar, not yet so much investment, but significant plans about what will happen. So to the extent that anyone on the U.S. side wonders whether there is Australian infrastructure investment that will enable this to happen, I've seen it with my own two eyes.
And I suppose the question is whether it's a qualified yes from America, because, you know, we had this United States congressional report questioning whether Australia would definitely commit any subs that we do get into a potential conflict with China over Taiwan. And that was put as raising doubts about our full commitment. Now, is that something that you feel is coming to the forefront of debate in the US?
I'm very glad you asked that. I am the lead Democrat on the Armed Services Sea Power Subcommittee, so ship subs, Navy, Marines. The real origin and the driving motivation of AUKUS is not what commitments will Australia make in the event of hypothetical future military challenges. It's having this very, very powerful apex platform in the Indo-Pacific, near to where there may be challenges. Because if we have to rely on our own bases for, say, maintenance and repair, it takes an awful lot of time to get a Virginia-class sub back to Pearl Harbor or back to Virginia for major repairs. You want to have these subs available and in the water and doing the deterrence work they do. And having Australia completely equipped to do maintenance and operation.
But we'll retain sovereignty. Will we? Sorry to, like, you know, we're not going to be asked that question, are we not?
Well, I'm not asking that question. I'm confident in the relationship. This gives us the ability, working together, to provide the kind of stability. I don't think it's right to ask Australia to cede on sovereignty. I look at this as a complementary effort to protect both of our nations and the globe.
But see, this is a really interesting explanation of this question that I think Australians have been coming at time and time again ever since the announcement. What does force rotation mean for us in the event of conflict in this region in which the United States is engaged? You're talking about ports, you're talking about the physical infrastructure that will exist here in Australia because of AUKUS. Doesn't that, by virtue of your submarines coming here for servicing potentially during conflict, tie us to that conflict?
Well, look, this is a decision for Australia to make. And Australia has embraced this because of Australia's own awareness of the security challenges the nation faces. And I believe Australia probably understands these challenges even more acutely than the United States does because of the geographic proximity to where there may be conflict. And the desire to have this additional weapons platform, which is such a deterrent, I think is nothing but a positive. Now, there are details to work out, and I got into some very specific details that, as befitted my position, I used to be a mayor of Richmond and a governor of Virginia. So what's it like to be a mayor or governor in a state where there's significant nuclear assets? That's not been the case for these Australian communities. And it was interesting to kind of share my experience of being in a state that has had a nuclear navy and produces nuclear reactors for decades and decades. And it was good to be able to have that conversation with some of the local officials for whom this is a new thing. But for me, from the very moment this announcement took place, it suggested to me Australia is very aware of the challenges it faces. They're very aware of a capacity that the U.S. has. And if we can share in the kind of deployment and management of that capacity without either nation ceding sovereignty, both nations are going to be safer.
Well, the trouble is that remains to be seen. I mean, I suppose, is there a bipartisan view in Washington that you can detect that we need to be pretty clear about that question of whether we would commit, whether we would join in some sort of dispute with China, and also our defence spending? Now, I mean, these are crucial things for that Australia is agonising over, to be quite frank.
Yep.
So could you give us a sense of how that is being thought in Washington?
Yes. So this may surprise you. I have heard virtually zero discussion from the beginning of this announcement, when President Biden announced it, as to whether what commitment will Australia make in the event of an actual military conflict in the region. Virtually zero discussion. That's not been the motivator for this on our side, because, you know, we respect that Australia is going to make sovereign decisions about which conflicts that it believes it's in Australia's interest to engage in, and we're going to make the same decision. So the issue never comes up in the Armed Services or Foreign Relations Committees. Wait a minute. What commitment is Australia making about participating in conflict? That's not really the reason that we did this. Now, on the defense spending side, you follow, Donald Trump and his belief that allies should spend more. You follow that closely. There is an expectation of NATO nations that is measured in percentages, and NATO nations, you know, in the last 10 years have basically turned from mostly not meeting the expectation to overwhelmingly meeting the expectation. And I will actually give both Donald Trump and, frankly, Vladimir Putin credit for making European nations understand they need to invest more. The right level of defense investment for Australia, I don't have a number or a percentage, but I will say a nation that is willing to invest what Australia is investing in AUKUS, investing in the U.S. workforce to enable us to have the capacity to produce the Virginia-class subs that are in that Pillar 1, I don't have doubts about Australian resolve when it comes to budgetary resources.
So you think we will spend more, basically?
Yes. Yes. I think you will spend what you need to spend. And that what that level is, that's for you to decide. But if I go to, you know, if I go to Sterling and I see the amount of new construction and the pace of the rotations, and I look at the plans for Henderson, and I look at this really transformative announcement that was made by the Prime Minister and SA Premier, I don't have doubts about that the resources will be put up to the task to match the commitment.
Senator, there's obviously a complicated timeline here, but under the legislation that went through Congress in the United States, the President of the day still needs to sign off on handing over the submarines to
Correct.
Australia. So Donald Trump, if things go to plan, won't be the president by the time this happens, but he's talked about running again, and who knows what comes next.
Yeah.
Why should Australia trust the US president to do this?
I'm not going to sit in any audience and suggest blind trust is a strategy, but I just feel like the combination of the relationship we've built up, the uniform belief on the U.S. side, we don't have a better partner than Australia. If I talk to the military, whether it's the Pentagon or Indo-PACOM, we don't have a better partner than Australia. If I talk to my intelligence community, we don't have a better partner than Australia. So I think it is the commitment that's been made, the trust we have in our partner, and then President Trump, who actually, I think you could say, he has folks in the administration who described in the past tense, themselves as AUKUS skeptics. But after a period of kicking the tires and analyzing this, President Trump has come out in a full-throated way. And it's not just what he's saying. It's also in budgetary resources that were put in the reconciliation bill that Congress passed last June, but also the president's FY27 budget is about to be submitted to Congress. And everything we're hearing is suggesting that the investments in the ship and sub-building component of our military are going to be extremely robust.
But I mean, I suppose we need to know whether you in the US know what it's like to be us at the moment. You know, here we were in Australia with this incredible psychological dependence on the US over so many years. So how would you advise us who feel our values might be even seriously verging now? It's not just trust, it's values, to develop robust attitudes at a time like this.
Well, look, I share a lot of the emotion in that question. You know, I'm a Democrat. I was part of a ticket that ran against President Trump in 2016. I am extremely critical to many things that he has done, in particular things like the tariff policies and other things he's doing that seem to demean alliances and often by doing so empower adversaries. So we could, if we want to turn this into just a discussion about Donald Trump, I got a lot I could talk to you about. But I think the issue of President Trump is whatever I think about the way he makes decisions and whatever percentage of the decisions he makes that I agree with or not, on this particular matter, I think he has kicked the tires and concluded it's the right thing to do. And I'm telling you, in our system, Congress is the Article I branch and the executive is Article II. We stay around for a lot longer than presidents do. And we are very, very committed to this. And then the other thing that, you know, I think is an important thing to factor in, Australia decided this was something you need. This was not us demanding, asking, pleading, begging, please, Australia, please do this. Australia decided and had to make a tough, risky decision because Australia was going down a particular path on diesel subs with the French and on your own, you know, without us demanding or even asking, Australia made a decision that the security environment in the Indo-Pacific is so significant in its impact on Australia that you needed to take a different path. That decision was made for a set of reasons. I don't think those reasons have changed. If anything, I would suggest the reasons have probably become more manifest since AUKUS was announced.
You're listening to Global Roaming from Radio National. Our guest this episode is the US Senator Tim Kaine, and we're really trying to get answers to some of your burning questions on AUKUS.
But stay tuned as well for his peacekeeping mission to Mark Carney in Canada. It may surprise you.
So that's the politics and maybe some of the emotion in this complicated relationship.
Yes.
What about the practicalities? You've been talking about the fact that the production rate has lifted in Virginia, 1.13 vessels a year, I think. But to deliver on AUKUS, the production rate needs to lift above, I think, 2.3 per year to get there on this schedule. You're miles off.
We are. We have invested massively in the submarine industrial base to increase
production. We've invested too, haven't we? We've given you quite a lot of money for this.
Yes. Oh, you've given us $1 billion and there's a second billion coming and maybe a third billion coming. But we have made major investments and those investments are paying off with increases in production at both Newport News, the shipyard that I represent, Huntington Ingalls, and also Electric Boat in Connecticut. So we are seeing improvement. I will also say, putting an asterisk by the 2.33, the 2.33 was based on an assessment that we would need to produce two Virginia-class subs a year for the United States, and the commitment made to Australia in the 2030s basically added an additional 0.33 a year in the 2030s to meet the commitment to Australia. We are doing some reassessment on our side about whether the U.S. needs two. We're not reassessing the commitment to the Australians because, as you know, and Australia is a great innovator in this, we are looking at the right mix of crewed and uncrewed subsurface vessels. And as new technologies come on board, it's ultimately not necessarily about, you know, what is the name of the sub that's put in the water. It's about what capacity needs to be delivered. And there's new and exciting and very innovative ways to deliver capacity that may shift on the U.S. side, whether the right number for the U.S. is two Virginia classes a year. I don't want to predetermine the outcome of that analysis, but there's recently been some discussions, including in the CRS report, about what might be needed as we're now starting to field more and more undersea platforms that are different than the conventional Columbia class or Virginia class subs.
I wonder if I could ask you about how you reacted to the Mark Carney speech at Davos and the question of, you know, again, this whole idea that the world that we're all talking about and we are tonight really, you know, is going to be one that we recognise.
I'm going to start by saying I went to Ottawa to spend time with Mark Carney right after he was elected. It's kind of rare when, you know, a U.S. senator feels the need to go to Canada on a peacekeeping mission. But, I mean, that's the first time I've had to do it in 13 years in the Senate. But it was a great meeting. And there are not leaders on the global stage who I would rank above Mark Carney. There might be some that I would put on the podium with him, but I don't think I'd rank many above him. But I will, and I think much of what he said was a powerful wake-up call. But there's a piece of what he said that I disagree with very strongly. When he said, we have to admit that the rules-based order is dead, and it's now a reality-based order. Reality-based order translates to might makes right. I don't know what reality-based order means other than the powerful write the rules and the less powerful suffer under them. That is not anything we should accept. A rules-based order is so vastly preferable to the, quote, reality-based order that preexisted it for centuries that we shouldn't give up on the idea. Now, should the rules-based order, if it has become less viable or more subject to attack from authoritarians, do you have to think about new ways of looking at the rules? Do you think in new ways to let, you know, middle-sized nations achieve greater power? Are there problems with the rules that have been established that need rethinking? All that's fair game. But if you concede rules-based order is dead, it's a reality-based order, you're giving up way too much, and I would never, never embrace that position.
But isn't that exactly what the Trump administration has been and is doing?
Donald Trump is doing it in some ways. He's going to be president for the next 2.5 years. We're going on as a nation. We're celebrating 250 years of democracy this year, and we're not intending to give it up, and we're not intending to give up the diplomatic role that this nation has played since Teddy Roosevelt won the Nobel Prize for brokering the end of the Russo-Japanese War more than 125 years ago. We want to play that role together with other nations, and maybe if we've felt like we've occupied too many seats at the table, well, then let's bring other seats up to the table and make that more equal. But don't give up on the idea of the rules-based order. And even if Donald Trump has done it.
Or yourselves, by the sound of it, you're saying don't give up on them.
I was going to say, is this American self-belief here that we're listening to? Because there's a lot of people in the world that might say, look, this was coming for a long time and Trump just blew the whole thing up and you're never going to get it back.
Well, you know, look, I have no reason to be pessimistic. You know, my life experience, and I'm going to be biased, I'm a Virginia politician. Virginia has a whole lot of scar tissue in our history. And in the last 25 years, we've probably been, in my view, one of the best political turnaround projects in the United States, from backward looking to forward looking. Just give you a couple of stats. I'm 68. When I was born, Virginia was 1 out of 100 immigrant. And we were bottom quarter per capita income. Today, we're 1 out of 8 immigrant, and we're top quarter per capita income. There's nothing we're doing we can't do better, but Virginia is really looked at as a model state right now. We just had wonderful elections in November, history-making elections in November. So I've seen in my own state an amazing transformation for good. Why would I give up on the notion that the U.S. could do the same thing? So I get that people are nervous and worried about things that President Trump says and does, and I am too, and so are my colleagues. I hate seeing the abuses that are being perpetrated on people by immigration officials in some of our cities, but I also see everyday Americans taken to the streets and standing up against them, as they are guaranteed the right to do in the Constitution. You have the right to peacefully assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. Our founders understood that elections weren't enough. If elections were enough, you would need to guarantee the right to people to protest and petition. That muscle is being exercised in an amazing way in the United States right now, as are the electoral muscles. And I believe we're going to go through this 250th year, and it's going to be a celebration, not a requiem or a wake. We're going to power forward, playing an important role.
I just must ask you about the Reverend Jesse Jackson dying.
Yeah.
And, you know, a real giant. I felt very sad about that, you know, the American Civil Rights Movement. And, of course, he ran for president twice.
Twice,
for the
right.
Democrats. Now, how does he fit into this America you're describing?
he played an iconic role. I want to go back and watch this, but when I was on the ticket with Hillary Clinton in 2016, when I gave my speech accepting nomination at Philadelphia, I looked down and Jesse Jackson was sitting in the front row. And I had been instructed when the speech was over to stand on the stage and, you know, wave to the crowd. My family would join me. Instead, I saw him sitting there. And I have known Jesse since I was mayor of Richmond back in the 90s. So instead of doing what I was told to do, I finished the speech and I walked down those steps to embrace him. And I just, over the years, even though, you know, he was a Chicago guy and I'm a Richmond guy, just interacted with him as mayor and then as governor of Virginia and in the Senate. And he is a towering figure. And as President Obama said, there would have been no President Obama had Jesse Jackson not paved the way for that race. We will really miss him. If he was here and heard me say that, or if his spirit is hearing me say that, he would say, yeah, okay, you can miss me, but look at all these great young people you have out there that are marching in my footsteps and doing things that I did and maybe even doing more. We got a great talent pool who have been inspired by Jesse Jackson, and that's his real legacy.
Is it true you carry six harmonicas with you everywhere you go?
I do. You just never know when you'll need one. I mean, there's got to be a 24/7 emergency harmonica service.
Why not now?
have you got one with you?
I have them in the backpack in the car, not here in the studio. But I play music all over Virginia, and I'm an enthusiastic amateur. But when people, even in the reddest parts of Appalachia, hear me get up on stage and I play by ear, they're like, you know that Kane? Wow. We kind of like that guy. We're not voting for him, but we kind of like that guy. It's an icebreaker.
Senator Tim Kaine, really grateful to you for talking to us. Thank you so much.
Lovely to talk
to you. So glad to be with you guys. Thanks Bye-bye. Much.
So no harmonica to close us out, Geraldine, but plenty to think about.
Yeah, plenty. He was very impressive, I thought. He was very impressive. I thought that he, by the emphasis on a joint project where they didn't have expectations of Australia. Incidentally, I don't believe that. I think they most definitely have expectations of Australia that we will commit to any possible war. But he didn't emphasise it. Now, that was quite interesting.
Well, I actually want to re-listen to his precise wording. I want to read the wording once it's transcribed, actually, because for me, often, particularly American politicians, it's this sort of very nuanced, very subtle wording. And I think the stuff about, well, there isn't an expectation. Neither country cedes sovereignty, but we think by making this commitment, your interests will somehow align with ours. I don't want to paraphrase him incorrectly, but to me, there was still a message in there about what that expectation is. I mean, there's a physical reality, right, in wartime to having American submarines basing here or moving through here. That's just a physical reality, which he's acknowledging.
Oh, it is. I've always felt that the rotations are one thing. It's us buying and putting so much money into buying these subs and whether that is a good use of our defence money. I've thought that's a separate issue. It's the question of whether we should be continuing these giant down payments.
But there's a drop-down menu, right? From the point of there's a conflict, there are American submarines basing here, rotating through here, coming for servicing here.
Does that make us a target?
Well, does that draw us into a conflict anyway? And then we have no choice about whether or not we're using these submarines in that. So there's a cascading set of decisions.
Now, don't forget to write to us. We do really value your questions and your feedback, so please keep it coming. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Our thanks, as usual, to Kylie Morris, Shane Anderson and Aston Brown. Have a good weekend, Hamish.
Bye-bye for now.